said, fuck it, let's do it. Welcome, everybody. Welcome back to Open Mic with me, Mike Creed. Had a little bit of a break. A little bit more busy with the job than I thought I was going to be, which probably shouldn't be a surprise to me, considering I've never had a real job before. So this is a facsimile of a real job. It's not necessarily a real job, but still proving to be hard to manage my time correctly. I don't know what the fuck I'm saying. I'm just saying cliche things right now. Excuse me. This week on the podcast, Dustin Judice. This might be the first non-professional I've ever had in the podcast, and let me tell you what happened. He had sent me messages before saying how much he appreciated the podcast and how it really helped him with his PTSD, and I thought that was really pretty cool. And then I was driving a team car from the service course to team camp, and he just happened to send me a message asking me different ways to become a professional rider. And I noticed from his Twitter profile that I was 30 or 40 miles away from the town he lived in. So I said, I'll do you one better and I'll pull over and let's talk. So, never met him before this, and I feel like we had a really good talk. I mean, you have to apologize for the audio quality. It's the last time we use these mics. Leslie got me a better mic, so this is the last time you're gonna hear subpar audio, hopefully. But it was really windy out, and there was really busy out, but it was the only place I could talk to Dustin, so try to bear with it. I think it's worth it. Podcast, as always, sponsored by Cardo Cyclist. You can get 15% off. You get a 15% off coupon after purchase. So what that means is if you buy like a $4,000 bike, you get a gift certificate for $600. If you get, if you buy $100 worth of things, I think you get like a $72 gift certificate. I'm pretty sure. Let me check my math. Yeah, that's it. So I encourage you to go buy stuff at Cardo Cyclist. Scam them out of... just tell them how much you think the gift certificate should be. And that would be amazing. That'd be a big help. Also, pay attention to anything in the future. We have... talking to other people about sponsoring the podcast, so looking to get you loyal fans as much swag as possible. Beyond that, I'm going to try to keep these podcasts coming, folks, but this, I'm really lucky. I have amazing staff, and I have amazing riders, and I have amazing team owners, and everybody's on board, and we're doing great. We did tour Mexico with three teams are doing tour California, and I think we showed that we were stronger than all of them, at least at that particular time. So I think we're making a really strong case for ourselves. Side note, many of you guys also know that Leslie is shutting down Cyclismus, and she's been instrumental and key to bringing this podcast to light. So if you guys wouldn't mind sending her a note and telling her how much you appreciate the podcast and you appreciate her for helping out, you're my friends for life.
Dave, you're on Running First.
Ronnie B, you sound like $1 million.
Thank you, my friend.
I've noticed that a lot of people who find God late in life do so as a result of some tragedy, some loss, some personal failure. And I want to know if you or any of your listeners have ever heard of somebody who was leading a well-balanced, rewarding life and were comfortable in their own skin and then one day found God.
I certainly don't have the religious upbringing that Fez has, where it was drummed and you go in and blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't sit around and quote the Bible with people. But I do realize that in most religions, the path that you're supposed to be on is somewhere where you feel some humility and awe, a feeling of awe in the miracle of existence. I feel like I already have that. I feel like I have a quema, and of course appreciation. I get all three of those. I don't know whether I have to go around and give that a fucking name or try to figure out exactly how it works. This whole thing of people wanting to know how the universe works. Could you rebuild a fucking airplane engine? No. Could you fucking fix a refrigerator? No. And yet you want to come up and figure out who was the architect behind bees? You're fucking stepping a little high, my friend. We have never invented anything. Man has never invented anything that could be compared to a fucking bee in terms of being able to do exactly what it was designed to do. So this whole thing of I'm going to try to guess what my path is, or something hurts my feelings, so there must be a greater reason behind this. There's the lack of fucking humility for you, you know? And there is a less of a sense of appreciation and awe in the miracle of any existence. So no, I don't need to walk down to a church to hear that guy start to try to tell me that the fucking universe is an amazing goddamn place. When I go walking down the street and it's hard to not start running over the fucking excitement level of being alive. But now I've got other people who are like dragging ass around and they all want to drag themselves in and hear a droning, ridiculous speech about how we should be fucking happy that we are in some kind of existence. I fucking get that. I get it. Try to go for that fucking feeling once in your life. Just the appreciation alone of being here. But now you think you can one-up this thing and try to figure out whatever force of nature came up with fucking gravity? What am I going to have? A one-on-one fucking conversation with that person? It's crazy.
So the Milky Way. That's floating around everyone.
I can't play a piano, and yet I want to figure out how the fucking universe exists and why and what makes everything happen. The insane level that we have, and it does come from a fucking lack of appreciation. Period. Period. The fact that, oh, I want more. You're not appreciative that you got anything. You won't see people walk around the planet that appreciate the fact that their asshole works properly. And believe me, if your asshole didn't work properly today, you wouldn't be thinking of another fucking thing. And now we want to sit around and fucking figure out what it's all about. Jesus. Insane. The ego of fucking human beings. I'll tell you. One thing that I do admire about dogs is they don't fucking sit around and wonder how things work.
Oh, no.
And they definitely are appreciative.
Well, they enjoy lots of things.
That's and they'll go time. On a fucking adventure. They will go on an adventure.
Yeah. What's that?
What's your last name?
Jadis.
Jadis.
Yeah. When I was in the army and stuff, they called me Judas. So even from like day zero, it was bad. My drill sergeant would be like, you know, holy crap, we got Judas Priest here. And it was downhill from there. Right. So like 4 years I was Judas, but it's Judas, yeah.
How long? You're really pretty young, man. Like how long were you in the army for?
4 years.
4 years?
Yeah.
What age did you get in?
18.
What are you now?
26.
Why'd you get in the army so early? Nothing else to do?
Kind of at the time, Iraq was super unpopular, and I read too many history books as a kid and probably watched Patton too many times, and I just kind of felt obligated to do it, you know, and so that's why.
Do you have a history of it in your family?
Yeah, a little bit. Both of my grandparents were, like, drafted in the Army and stuff, but it wasn't like, you know, like a everyone does it type of thing. It was more like a... kind of felt obligated to do it slash you're 18 and stupid type of thing. You know?
Do you regret it? Or?
No, but it's kind of interesting looking back on it because I got a lot out of the experience and stuff, but not like I got like a lot out of the experience and made some friends that I'll have, I guess, forever and experiences that are like, I mean, it's really helped mold me as a person in terms of, you know, having the ability to get stuff done and drive and everything like that. But it was a rough 4 years still at the same. Yeah.
Sometimes personal growth doesn't come from great circumstances.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
So it's like you're grateful that you did grow and you have things, but maybe there was a magical way to do it instead of going through some crazy shit.
Yep.
So you were in Iraq on and off for 4 years?
I only went once for 15 months. I went like literally kind of at the low point. We were part of General Petraeus' surge and stuff, so we showed up November of 2007, and the day I came back was 15 months later. Obama's inauguration day was the day we flew back. So, yeah, it was like that's how I know when he, you know, got sworn in again for a second term. Like, oh man, I've been back stateside for 4 years now.
Right, it was
weird.
Really missed out.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. Were you always riding bikes, or?
No, man, no. Like, it's crazy. I kind of got to give Lance a shout-out for that one. Like, right as I was getting out of the Army, I was kind of going through a lot, drinking a lot of beer and eating a lot of Domino's, you know. And just,
so you're 22 at this point?
Yeah. Putting on weight and everything. I did a little mountain biking and stuff when I was a kid, and mostly not even real mountain biking, just riding on a mountain bike around town and stuff, you know. Like, because I had put on a little bit of weight in high school at one point, that's how I lost it. But you know, like I put on a bunch of weight after I got back from my deployment and stuff, and I was trying to figure out a way to lose weight and kind of maybe get my act together right as I was getting out of the Army, which sounds funny.
Sure.
Like a lot of people in the military get really out of shape and put on a lot of weight during a deployment and then coming back because they're depressed and, you know, all this other stuff. And
they don't have to have that regimented thing anymore. I think you're so used to somebody making you be disciplined.
Yeah.
The second that person's not there anymore, you kind of forgot how to do it on your
own. Well, this was even while I was still in. Like, the last year I was in, like, no one cared because we were all, like, kind of separated off where guys are getting out, and they're like, I'll do what you want.
Yeah.
And so it was like, you know, it used to be you show up to running for, like, physical training formation in the morning, but for us, they're like, oh, you got to get out. I don't need to go run. You know, go do something else. And so anyway, like... You know, I was thinking to myself, like, I don't like running because I've been running in the Army all this time. Well, I remember when I was a kid, I liked bike riding, and I was like, well, if it's good enough for Lance Armstrong, it's good enough for me. So literally, you know, I called the bike shop, and I was like, yeah, what are those bikes that Lance Armstrong rides? You know, like,
really?
Not having a clue, like, and the guy was like, road bikes and stuff. And you know, the crazy part is I live north of a cycling mecca. I was in Fort Hood for 4 years, north of Austin.
Yeah.
And I never took advantage of it till like right at the end. Yeah. And even then, not really, because I got a bike like, I guess right as I was getting out. And, you know, I did a little bit of Google research and stuff, and like, okay, this stuff seems pretty cool. And it was just a snowball effect after that. Like, I guess that year, I watched the Tour de France for the first time, and I mean, and I actually coming back home, I put on some more weight and stuff, and then, you know, one cold December 2010, however many years ago that is now, I guess 3 or 4, I was like, man, I got to do something because I was weighing 285.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you at now, like 180?
No, 160.
160?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I'm kind of still 10 pounds off, you know, that.
What, your ideal weight?
Yeah, my ideal racing weight, I think, would be about 150. And I still got a little bit of a gut, so it's like, it's hard to fight the beer and everything.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, the bike's been great to me because I lost over 130 pounds and stuff like that. And so it's, yeah, it's kind of like reeled me back in. Yeah. You know?
That's great, man.
Yeah.
Well, so for those who don't know, you sent me a message on Twitter about, like, hey, man, like, how do you make it into pro cycling?
Yeah, yeah. Like,
it just happened, like, I'm road tripping now.
Yeah.
Winston-Salem to Tucson. And I looked at your Twitter profile, saw you're in Lafayette. Boom, I was like 2 hours from Lafayette. So I said, let's have coffee, let's figure this out.
Yeah, yeah.
So, what category are you now?
I'm a Cat 4.
Okay.
So I'm still, like, you know, ways out. Like, I started racing in 2011, and I picked up a coach and everything. And I mean, really, even the first, like, even racing in 2012 is just trying to lose the weight. And so it's finally coming around now to where, you know, instead of riding to gain, you know, just health, now it's actually going, like, more towards a fitness thing. So I'm still, like, really kind of developing almost. So it's kind of strange because, you know, you'll ask people, and then they're like, oh, you're just starting. And it's like, well, yeah, I get it.
Well, I guess the first thing would be is, like, you got to get a coach. Mainly just, especially if you don't have a history of it in your blood, like, in your family.
Mm-hmm.
You need to, like, you need somebody you trust and that's going to help, like, that has some kind of history in the sport.
Yeah.
So they know things that you can't necessarily teach in a physiology book or a training manual. And then, I mean, I would follow that pretty strictly and just kind of see where it goes. And, like, yeah, man, like, if you go from Cat 4 to, like, Cat 2 or 1 in under 2 years, like, all right, so you're 26 now?
Yeah.
So with the UCI with Division 3 rules, it really helps. It's easier to sign guys who are under 28.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's tricky. So if you can get in under the wire there, then it lends a little bit more. It lends more to guys taking a chance, an outside chance.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, this year I took a chance on a guy I'd never really heard of. He was over 28. I think he's like 30, but I mean, to be frank, those aren't really pain spots. Those are just like,
yeah,
I'll give you a kit and a bike, and if you show up to camp and kick ass, then we'll take you to some races. And if you kick ass at that race,
yeah,
then you're in. But really, man, like, I think it's one of those things that, depending on how good you are, it almost takes care of itself.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
If you're just, wait, I mean, in Lafayette, like, is there a lot of racing? Or, like, do you guys go to, are there teams around that go to NRC races? Or anything
NRC?
Like, National Racing Calendar?
No, it's not, like, semi-pro amateur. It's just pretty amateur. We got our, like, our local circuit that I race and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, Mississippi and Louisiana, we're combined.
Yeah.
So that helps because it kind of keeps the calendar.
Are mostly crits or
road race, like, they do a lot of omniums, and so, like, it'll be like usually most of the races are 3-day weekends. It's a crit, a road race, and a TT.
Okay.
And I do pretty good at the time trials and stuff. Like, I love time trials. Like,
yeah,
that's my thing. Yeah, crits I'm okay at. Still, like, getting used to being in them.
In a bunch.
It's
yeah.
Crazy, man.
You got it, man. Like, the only thing that gets you better at field positioning is, like, you just start losing races because of it.
Yeah.
You get caught behind splits and guys opening up gaps on you and, you know, stuff like this, and you get so frustrated with it that eventually you just do it. Like, you barge your way to the front.
Yeah.
And then once you do it, the first time you do it, you never forget how to do it again. But, like, it's really something unexplainable. It's like,
yeah, yeah.
It's just born out of pure frustration.
I've I've had that happen to me. Luckily, we got a guy who used to race with Steve Haig and Thurlow Rogers and stuff. He used to live on the West Coast, and so he's like he's our team captain, and he's super strong. He's like a beast.
Yeah.
Like, his tempo power is like 260, which for you guys is nothing, but yeah, like, he's an animal. And so, like, tomorrow we'll go out and do tempo and stuff like that. And even on the group rides, he used to, you know, gap us, and or me specifically, and stuff like that, and I got tired of getting dropped, and so it's been this kind of progression. So yeah, I believe it when you're saying that.
Yeah, just don't be afraid to get frustrated, man. Just like, everything good is born out of frustration.
Yeah.
Anything positive. How is it here? I like this town. I just drove through it.
It's nice, man. This, like,
have you been here since birth? Like, is this
Yeah. Like, well, not Lafayette itself. I'm actually from about 25 miles out of town. Straight up BFE, like, kind of where you drop that thing at.
Oh, that's where I'm going to head after this, yeah.
No, well, kind of like it. I'm actually that way. The exits for New Iberia, did you see the... Or wait, no, you came in on I-10. So.
Yeah.
No, I'm from outside of New Iberia, so it's about 25 miles away, but I've always came to Lafayette. My grandparents live here, and my mom's from here and stuff. Yeah, it's a real nice town, because it's like... It's got a lot of culture, and it's got the whole Cajun thing going for it, and then there's a lot of good live music, and, you know...
Do you know much Cajun? Do you understand?
My grandparents, like, they speak it. I understand it pretty well and stuff, but it kind of fell off right around my generation and everything.
Yeah.
Like, they're fluent.
That's amazing, man.
Yeah.
It's amazing to think that, like, a language is just going to go away. It's too bad. You know?
Well, they've done a good job of, like, kind of keeping it around and really reinvigorating it. I hadn't really picked up on it, though, you know, like...
Sure.
But, yeah.
That's great, man. I think it's pretty cool. Like, I think that's the lucky part about the job I got now. Like, okay, I don't get to ride as much, but I do get to see, like... parts of the country that,
yeah, man,
like, you would never really be in before, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always liked the South a bit. Like, I lived in Georgia for a while, and I was like, the people were always really nice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for the most part, I mean, every once in a while you'd have like some farmer who tried running off the road, but
yeah
in general they're pretty nice.
Yeah, it's crazy, like, we got good cooking down here and a lot of friendliness, and then it's balanced with like a little bit of old school racism,
sure,
you know, to balance the scales out. But yeah, like, a lot of people are really friendly around here and stuff.
How did you like it, like, when you came back from the...
It was a lot to adjust to, man, because...
I mean, there are two, like, very extreme cultures, like, Army culture, Iraq culture, and then come down to Southern culture.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You're not living in any shades of gray.
No. Like, it was weird, and the thing that a lot of people don't talk about is that when you're in the military, despite how hard the job is in a lot of respects, you're covered in this huge security blanket because so much of life is taken care of for you. Like, you know, for the most part, when you're in the field or training, or even when you're in garrison, there's a meal that's ready for you, available, and you got everything you need. You don't have to worry about figuring out what insurance you got. You have the government to pay, you know.
Yeah.
The government covers your insurance. You have life insurance. You know, you have all this stuff. And so you have all these really good benefits that if you don't want to think about anything, you can literally kind of almost live your life on autopilot.
Especially if you got into it when you were 18.
Yeah, yeah.
So when you came back, like, it was just like a flood of responsibility you weren't used to?
No. I mean, because, like, it was weird because I dealt with, like, you know, being almost, well, really being responsible for people's lives and stuff like that because I was in a combat job and stuff.
What was your position?
I was a tank crewman on the Abrams, but then when we deployed to Iraq, we ended up just doing dismounted and mounted infantry type stuff. So we were just driving around
that.
On trucks.
Explain that. What that
like,
means.
Basically, just... Like, getting in a Humvee with three or four other guys and driving around town, and then we did a lot of
just
raids.
Just policing? Or?
Yep.
And you did raids, really?
Yeah.
Holy shit, dude.
Yeah. I usually didn't go in. I was the driver for my platoon sergeant, and So for the most part, I'd stay with the gunner in the truck. But I did a few raids, not too many. It was like cops.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy. It's like the best analogy I have for Iraq is like the movie Training Day for like 15 months. Like, yeah, it was a lot of, like, for instance, at the beginning of our deployment, we were deploying to this area with this guy. His name was Noman Jawar, and he was a local Al-Qaeda in Iraq cell leader in the area. And he was directly responsible for killing some U.S. troops from the unit before us and everything. And, you know, we got a tip like a month after we got there, maybe three or four weeks after we got there. And they're like, yeah, the Iraqis found out he's in this place or whatever. Like, let's go. And then they surround the place and they're unloading into the building and they're there fighting and everything. And then this Iraqi SWAT guy who was with us just ran towards the building. And I wasn't there at the time. This was the other platoons in my unit. And we were actually pulling guard that day and getting called out to go and help because, you know, we had tanks. So we're just going to blow a hole through the building. And they're like, they just quit shooting. And the guy ran into the building. And they're like, why did they quit shooting at this guy running across the field? And, I mean, he ended up killing all of them. So he was, like, tight with these guys. He was the Iraqi police SWAT guy. And, you know, so he was on the take on both sides. And he was the guy that gave the tip.
It must be so frustrating to, like,
very.
People work on both sides of
yeah, it. I mean, it was kind of like the Sopranos mixed in with Training Day almost. It was crazy, man.
How is it? I mean, because, like, I've never, like, dealt with anything remotely on that level, like, it seems so crazy to come back. Like, because I know how small world and cliquish cycling is. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Is it... I can only imagine, like, coming back from something like that into the U.S. and seeing how sanitized and really pretty boring everything is. Like, was that... Were you, like, you know, in that movie, what was the movie that Catherine Bigelow did? She won the, he was a bomb diffuser in Iraq.
And Hurt Locker. I've never actually seen that. Man.
Yeah, like, where he became addicted to the adrenaline. Like, did that happen to you at all, or did you just couldn't wait to get out of there?
It was weird, man, because, like, for me, it was almost that I was on autopilot for 15 months, and it was like there was some adrenaline there, but...
Is it like self-defense mechanism? Yourself?
I was locked down in a big sense, like, tried not to think about it a lot.
Yeah.
And it was weird, like, one of the sergeants in our unit, he was asking us, he was like, you guys don't get scared when you leave the wire? And I was like, no, I don't even think about it. It was just kind of like...
Do you think if you thought about it, you would just, like, have a panic attack?
Yeah, I mean, like, really kind of the best way I could describe how I operated was as drone-like as possible for a long time. And, like, it even got to the point where I felt dumber. Like, I couldn't read. Like, I'm a big history geek and stuff. I couldn't read nonfiction when I was in Iraq. I could only read, like, real, like,
fantastical, simple.
Yeah. Like, I read Lord of the Rings, like, twice when I was there, you know? Like, but I tried to pick up, words. I knew it by pattern. I'm like, I can't read this. Like, get a half page and fall asleep. And, like, stuff like that. Yeah, and it's like
I wonder if that was just you taking over and saying, like, if I saw how, like, terrible some of this stuff is and how complicated some of this stuff is, like, you might not do it
it was pretty mind-numbing a lot, like, and then especially, like, towards the end of the deployment, like, at the beginning, we didn't really realize that we were being had, but, like, my lieutenant about halfway through was a really bright guy, and he kind of, you know, started alluding to and kind of really just outright saying it, like, this is bullshit, like, this, it was a lot of, like, a lot of the mission was really, you know, the tips we would get from either the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army, for the most part, that was there was pretty, because they would bring in ethnic groups or people from different areas, so they weren't connected to the region, but the police and stuff and the militia were all local, so they would be like, they'd be really interconnected, so there'd be like, you know, over there and stuff is very tribal in the sense of, like, you know, eight generations back, if Joe Schmo killed Abdul's donkey, you know, they might remember that and be yeah. like, and when they're the police chief, they're gonna, you know,
yeah,
like
take,
for,
it, take back. Yeah.
yeah. For instance, like one time we went on the raid, with the Iraqi police that was with us, and they had all their vehicles broken, and so like. Come to find out that we assumed we couldn't prove it, but they went around town one day and found the list of the people with the nicest cars and threw those guys on the terrorist list so they could, you know, confiscate their vehicles. And we're like,
what the fuck?
Yeah.
When you say you were being had, what do you mean?
Like in the sense of, well, kind of like that, that the locals were playing, you know, they were kind of probably
just
playing both sides.
You.
Yeah, yeah. And it was hard to tell who was telling the truth and everything. And it was a very fuzzy mission, like, looking back on it. It was like what we were doing directly. Like, we did do some good, but at the same time, it was like, is the net good here positive? Probably not. Definitely not. I could...
Yeah, there was like, I don't know if you listened to This American Life, but there was a one this last week where a soldier that was over in Iraq was just saying, like, I got to the point where, like, he just hated the Iraqis because, like, you would see people die, and then you see your friends die, and then you see you getting misled, and then they can't, like...
Yeah.
At one point, like, he realized how wrong it was. Like, he realized that was, like, I'm not thinking correctly.
Yeah, I hated them at the time a fair bit, too. And like, looking back on it now, you know, I feel like I've gained a lot of empathy because, you know, people come up to me and talk about how evil the Iraqis were, or thank you for serving and everything, and it's like, oh, this sucks or that sucks or whatever the comment is. It doesn't really matter what it is. And the point I try to bring up is like, you know, you do understand that if a bunch of Soviet tanks or Russian tanks came rolling down this street here in Lafayette,
yeah.
you would probably try to grab a rocket-propelled grenade and shoot at them, you know?
Especially if they, like, because it does happen occasionally, like, the wrong person gets killed. Or
oh, all the time,
like,
yeah.
I mean, so, yeah, especially if...
I mean, we even had an Iraqi army colonel who... he was Kurdish, and we're still not sure if the dude knew the people before, if he just got antsy, but he unloaded an AK into this car and killed a retired Iraqi general and his wife. That's why we think he knew the guy. It was like,
yeah,
he was getting
yeah.
some payback.
Yeah.
But yeah, he just murked him in front of all of us.
Jesus.
Yeah, it was like, you know... Kind of like at the end of the day, I'm able to relate more to the Iraqis now in a lot of respects than I do for the people, or than I do with the people who kind of sent me, because it's like, I understand where a lot of them came from the mere perspective of we're there in their land, and, you know. So it
how did that, like, affect you? You said you're a big history guy and everything. How did that affect you, like, politically? Or
I'm pretty glazed about it all now.
Just in the end, both sides. It's just it's only two choices.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
Did you, when you came back, did you struggle a lot? Did you go a lot of therapy, or?
Yeah.
I mean, it's still, like, kind of a... From what I gather, it seems like still like a little bit of a taboo for servicemen to come back and do therapy. Like,
yeah.
It is like such a macho thing.
I mean, the biggest thing that stops people from getting help is other service members, probably, and like the macho
social pressure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, the army or the military has done a pretty good job in the sense of, like, you know, it doesn't get put in your medical file, that to where they can look at it for promotions and stuff. And it's totally, like, hidden in the respect of how the appointment shows up. So, you know, you gotta say, oh, I got an appointment. You don't have to say what it is, but still.
Do you ever think there'll be a culture change where it'll be a little more accepted?
I mean, I think it has probably gotten a bit accepted. But the thing is, the military's probably hit a critical mass with the amount of people that has served, so it'll probably be easier once all these, like, people have been deployed and seen all this stuff. It'll probably be easier to revert to the old way once all these people start getting out of retiring, and so, like, now might be the best time. Maybe it'll change a little bit, but probably not. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That's a tough one because I have no ability to gauge it because I got out completely. I've talked to my buddies, but most of the people that I serve with have either the ones who are still active duty, I don't stay as close with, and that's not anything personal. It's just that they're busy. Yeah. And quite a few of them have deployed a bunch more times.
Did you ever consider re-enlisting?
Yeah, like my unit was going back again, but I really, like, they were going back to Iraq one more time, and they offered me like a really sweet extension deal. At the time, it seemed sweet, but I mean, it really wasn't like worth it, because I wanted to get out and go to school while I was still kind of young and stuff. And so, like, yeah, I considered it, but at the same time, like, I was not maximum potential. Because I mean, really, like, I wanted to go in through West Point, but I made the mistake of telling the truth to the medical board, and I had like asthma as a kid and stuff like that. And the one thing the Army recruiters or any recruiter will tell you when you go into a recruiting station is just to lie. Say you had chicken pox and you wear glasses and that's it. They don't
even
know the rest.
I've heard of the Army recruiters lying to recruits, just saying like, oh no, like,
yeah,
we'll get you these special deals. We're just not going to put it on the paper. Just sign the paper. And,
sure, yeah. Even my platoon sergeant, who was a recruiter, was like, you know, if the people work serious, like, there's a lot of people who show up in that door to the recruiting office and have no idea what they're getting into.
Yeah.
And I kind of, like, even though I was young and stuff, I had a pretty good idea of, like, look, I want this job and everything. And they were really straight up with me, but I kind of knew what I was getting into. I had no idea, but I still had a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Like, on a certain level of understanding. But there's a lot of people just going like, I just want to play Call of Duty, dog.
Yeah.
Like, it's like Call of Duty in real life. Like, no, man, no. But
what would you tell, like, a kid like that coming in the door saying, oh, I just want to play Call of Duty? Like,
I'd put my palm in my face probably at this point. I'd be like, no, man.
What is it like? If somebody asks you, what is it like when you go in?
Oh, like just the basic training and stuff like that. Basically, it's a huge human brainwashing exercise.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about it, you're getting a group of people to stand in a square formation, irregardless of the weather and stuff, and you could have them stand for hours on end if you wanted to. It's a trained, like, human conditioning type of thing. I mean, they literally kind of do change how you think in a lot of ways. And it's not necessarily for a bad thing, but it is different.
No, if you have a group of people that you need control over, it's probably best to not encourage individuality.
Yeah, oh yeah.
I mean, no, it's good and bad. It keeps the people in command knowing where everybody's at, but at the same time, socially, maybe in the long run, it might not be.
Yeah, it's weird. I've tried to take the balance from it, and like, it's really helpful in terms of being able to think on my feet and problem solving and stuff like that. And it's amazing because, like, I go to college now and everything, and kind of seeing the difference between how, like, you know, I can think on the fly in a certain respect versus, like, most of these people are just out of high school and everything, but they don't have that, like, innate, like, like, it's amazing how much of human nature is just, you know, if someone's there sounding authoritative, people believe you.
Yeah. It's crazy. So you're always going to go to the alpha. You're like, well, this guy seems pretty confident.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not. I'll go.
Yeah, yeah,
I'll
go with him. Oh, yeah.
I just completely brain farted on a question. When you came back, like, when you were saying earlier, like, I've always wondered when people say, like, support our troops and think it's, like, this really, like, easy cliche thing to say happen, but then, like, you see, like, retirement benefits or they're not getting treatment for PTSD or anything like stuff like this. Do you always kind of, like, I would imagine, so maybe I'm projecting, but I would imagine that would be, like, incredibly frustrating to hear, like, to see bumper stickers and stuff like this, and you're like, you're not there giving them jobs when they come back.
Right. A while back I kind of made a Facebook post. I wish I could pull it up, but the gist of it is like, basically, you know, I kind of went through that whole thing, like, especially right when I got back and got out of off of active duty and stuff, of like just being kind of angry at everyone, and when someone would say thank you, I wouldn't know, you know, like what to talk about and
You're
stuff.
You're welcome.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, okay. And but now, like, the thing I would say is like, thank you for your, if someone would say thank you for your service, I'd be like, well, sure, okay, whatever, but you know, the thing you should do is become politically more active and voice your opinions and concerns. And like at the end of the day, like, you know, you're talking about like people not getting treatment for PTSD and stuff like that. Like the you know, and the biggest kind of problem like with it all is like the easiest way to help with that is to make less veterans. And so, like, that's my solution in the big scheme of things. Make less, not necessarily less veterans, but less war veterans. Because, yeah, like, the big problem that people have, even with the taboo culture of, like, the military seeking help, is on the individual level. Like, there's a lot of roadblocks in place, like, you know, army suicides are sky high, and
yeah,
unemployment's always been a big thing for veterans coming out, especially war veterans, and their whole struggle with PTSD and seeking help and kind of the obtuseness of the VA. But at the end of the day, you could have a gold-plated road of benefits and everything for these guys, and a lot of them still wouldn't seek help because it's all in their mind. I mean, like, I was there in that same circumstance too, to where I didn't want to get any help.
Yeah.
And that's like the biggest thing I'd say to people is, like, you know, please try to make less veterans. Like, if it's gonna go down, make sure it's worth it, because Iraq wasn't worth it in Afghanistan. You know, at first might have been okay, but you know, we've been, you know, no one talks about that. We're still there. It's 2014.
Yeah. So. We're just making more enemies at this point. I don't remember the stat. I don't know if you remember, but I think it was up to something insane. Like, the, I don't know if it was Iraqi war veterans, Afghanistan one, but it was like averaging 2 suicides a week.
Yeah.
I want to say 4, but I'm going low because I don't want to overstate it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was like, it was something.
It was high.
And you never hear about it in the news. You never, like. And then, yeah, it always kind of irked me because I don't know, like, where I go politically. Like, I think both sides are pretty. I'm at the point of opting out.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am too.
But it always irked me when people would say, like, oh, I support my troops, and it's just like, I doubt it.
Yeah.
I don't think you not wishing ill will and hoping that people are okay is a lot different than support.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you're just being a good human.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, congratulations. Well, you're a good human. You don't wish people harm.
Uh-huh.
I think support is a little different.
Yeah, and then a lot of that, I think, has to do with, like, that's just guilt left over probably from Vietnam. They're like, you know, we really screwed those Vietnam guys up. Let's try not to do this again.
Just living your life. Like, even if...
Yeah.
I mean, I have guilt, too, because, like, I am clad in spandex, riding my bikes around with other dudes clad in spandex, and complaining to my friends, like, I have the hardest job in the world, and then... So it's easy to say, like, oh, I support my troops, because, like, there's a part of you that feels like, yeah, I'm really not doing anything but frivolous activity with my life.
It's okay. You know, because, like, even the guy, like, you know, I serve, but I would love to do frivolous activity for my life. It's like, it's crazy, man. It's cool.
No, it's the best, man. I hope you make it. Like, and just, you know, anything... any kind of tips or advice or anything?
Yeah.
I look forward to seeing how you progress, man.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because, like, I hadn't had a lot of time to race and stuff and make it to races because with school, so I'm trying to balance, you know, putting in 15 hours a week or so and trying to keep my grades up. So it's a fun road. I don't like the next step, like, lately it's been like kind of wild hair up the ass, like, well, maybe I'll just sell all my stuff and buy a plane ticket to Belgium.
You know, that right there.
Yeah.
I'm not co-signing on that one.
Yeah. But it's cool because, I mean, cycling's been great to me. Like, it really saved my life because, you know, I was pretty self-destructive right as I was getting out of the Army. And then, I mean, the people I have around here are great. Like, you were asking earlier if we have a good cycling culture. It's not huge. It's not Austin. And, you know, I've rode in Austin and stuff a few times, actually pretty recently. And I mean, it's immense over there. But, like, here, it's very tight-knit, and our race team is great. It's all mostly masters guys. Like, out of the people who consistently ride, I'm the youngest guy there. So yeah. It's all really experienced dudes for the most part. And so it's cool. And then, you know, we got our weekly thrash session on Saturdays. And, you know, we try to keep it up and stuff. But, yeah.
That's great, man. I think cycling needs more stories like yours, you know, instead of, you know, like the typical frontline, you know, whatever bad things that happen in cycling this week. I don't know, man.
Yeah, that's why I enjoyed yours and Frankie's conversation. It was like, yeah, I'm kind of, you know, I kind of went through the whole, oh, yeah, let's talk about doping thing, too. But it's like, yeah, I don't care.
Well, I mean, it is.
It's important.
I've said it before in the podcast. Like, I think at a certain point, like, the kind of skull drudgery of cycling is sometimes more interesting than a bike race.
Oh, yeah.
So I think it's always going to get talked about. I think it's just good to try to balance it out, you know. Like, it's not necessarily Velo-News or cycling's fault, because those guys just have to create an insane amount of content.
Yeah, they gotta make volume. It's cool. Yeah. I get it.
So, doing a, I think if you can add to the noise at all. But I don't know, man. I look forward to seeing you progress. And
oh yeah, thanks.
Feel
man.
Free to reach out at any time. All right.
Yeah, I will, man. I will.